presenting the category as a whole. Encourage other advocates to use these strategies and to think more critically about this topic. We should continue to consider whether these strategies actually are the most promising, because the research is always evolving. Reaching around the globe. As the movement expands around the globe, advocates need to make tough decisions about which regions to prioritize and how to adapt their messaging and strategies to different cultures. In this section, we'll consider which countries to prioritize working in and how to go about that expansion. Where are the most animals suffering? The Open Philanthropy Project tackles the world's most pressing problems. It's a collaboration between GiveWell, one of the first organizations in the effective altruism movement, and now the world's leading impact-focused charity evaluator, and Good Ventures, the $8 billion foundation established by Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz and his wife, Carrie Tuna. They're now the leading funder in the farmed animal movement, and like other effective altruist organizations, are tackling the challenge of international expansion. To do this, Lewis Ballard, an advocacy researcher at the Open Philanthropy Project, first asked how many animals live on factory farms at any given time in different countries. He compiled data from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and Fish Count, which is recognized as the leading organization tracking the number of fish killed and consumed globally. What Ballard found is that approximately 49% of all farmed animals live in a single country, China. There's significant uncertainty in this figure of 60 billion animals, but it's clearly much higher than the next largest, 8 billion in India. Moreover, as the quickly growing populations of these countries become more wealthy, they increase their consumption of animal products, which are more expensive. Pei Su is a Taiwanese activist leading animal protection campaigns in East Asia. Su's father was Chinese, but he left mainland China for Taiwan after Chiang Kai-shek's defeat by Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communist Party in 1949. Su grew up in the White Terror, a 38-year period of anti-communist authoritarian rule in Taiwan. There was a curfew for all citizens between midnight and 5 a.m. In school, students were required to speak Mandarin instead of the native dialect of Taiwanese. Everyone lived cautiously, avoiding any actions or statements that could be interpreted as sympathetic to the Communist Party. Taiwan was poor. Meat was rare. In East Asia, it was usually considered a delicacy or garnish on a meal of vegetables, fruit, or soy foods like tofu. The Chinese character for plain, pronounced su, is actually the same character used to refer to vegetarian food. Less than a handful of times each year, her family got to enjoy a whole chicken. The most desirable part was the legs, which usually went to Sue's father and brothers. On her birthday, Sue was allowed a chicken egg or drumstick. When I spoke with her, she referred to big meat portions like steaks as a Western concept, a trend that has been quickly growing in popularity in East Asia over the last half century. Dairy was introduced to the region while Sue was still in school, and promoted to families as a healthy special treat that signaled their growing prosperity. Sue's mother, father, grandmother, and aunt all passed away when she was a young teenager. She learned about the regular beatings of peaceful protesters and the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. She told me, "The Tiananmen Square massacre filled me with an overwhelming sense of injustice. Death and killing made no sense to me." This inspired her to become a Buddhist and vegetarian. She became an activist when Taiwan transitioned to democratic rule. Sue eventually quit her day job of running a flower shop and started working full-time for the only Taiwanese organization actively working to draft animal protection legislation. She and a Buddhist monk conducted undercover investigations of animal farms and slaughterhouses, sharing the information with domestic and international contacts. Sue realized how compelling animal protection was for Westerners, so she decided to travel to the U.S. and Europe to learn how organizations there had been so successful. She completed a master's degree in the UK in social policy and animal rights, and now works with international and local East Asian groups to effect change for animals, with her nonprofit, ACT Asia. She and other advocates agree that the best groups to work directly on animal protection in a particular region are local groups whose members have a much better understanding of and ability to work with local culture and institutions. Unfortunately, China's animal protection movement still lags behind similar movements in the West. Taiwan has made some progress, but mainland China had no animal protection laws at the time of this writing. China has also rapidly adopted a factory farming food system. In 2000, around 35% of chickens raised for meat came from farms with more than 2,000 birds. By 2009, the figure had risen to 70%. Advocacy in China currently focuses mostly on simply raising awareness of animal issues. In 2014, Sue's organization, ACT Asia, hosted China's first animal-free fashion show, which featured no fur or animal-tested makeup and served entirely vegan fare. While animal welfare discussions are less common in China than in the U.S. and Europe, a 2011 Chinese survey did find that 70% of respondents thought it was somewhat inappropriate or extremely inappropriate to use a cement floor on pig farms, and 74% felt similarly about killing fowl near cages that housed live fowl. In the U.S., polls have suggested around 80% oppose similar blatantly cruel practices like fast-growth chicken breeding and extreme crowding. In that same Chinese survey, 72% expressed concern about overusing additives, 50% were concerned about overusing antibiotics, and 48% were concerned about bad taste caused by factory farming practices. However, significant minorities praised factory farming for high profits, 22%, high productivity, 33%, and fast growth for slaughter, 38%. There haven't been any similar questions put to Americans. Finally, only 37% of respondents had heard of the Chinese term for animal welfare, which, as an American, is hard for me to imagine. When I first heard that low percentage, I hardly believed it, but Chinese advocates I've spoken with have confirmed that animal welfare is just not an established concept in their country. What about India, the country with the second largest number of farmed animals? Ballard describes India as a nation of contradictions for animals. It has the world's largest number of vegetarians, despite being the second largest consumer of animals. This is partly due to India moving away from red meat and toward poultry and eggs, similar to the rise in poultry consumption we saw in the U.S. starting in the second half of the 20th century, though U.S. egg consumption per capita has decreased, while India consumption has increased. Some advocates are less concerned about animal farming in low-income countries like India because they presume that farms are more pastoral, natural, and humane. We already saw that China is moving animals into factories at a rapid pace, and unfortunately, India has already adopted the factory farming system as its dominant method of animal farming. As Ballard learned in a 2017 research visit to India, even the animals' genes are sometimes from U.S. companies, meaning the animals there are also bred to suffer from overactive meat, dairy, or egg production. When I spoke with him, Ballard told me about the numerous challenges of working in India. One is that the retail system is distributed and diverse. For example, 90% of chickens raised for meat are sold live at local markets, so advocates can't simply target a few large retailers like they can in the West. Additionally, there is a substantial controversy in India over the consumption of cow meat. Cows are considered sacred by some Hindus, so advocacy on behalf of cows can be perceived as nationalist and intolerant of non-Hindu religions. Animal advocates try to steer clear of this, such as by focusing on chickens. The last thing to consider about India is that it has fairly strong animal welfare laws. For instance, in 1960, the Indian Parliament passed a remarkably progressive law to prohibit the confinement of animals in cages without a reasonable opportunity for movement. And in 2012, the government warned the egg industry that battery cages didn't meet this criterion and needed to be phased out by 2017. However, every farm Ballard visited in his 2017 trip to India still used battery cages, and none had plans to transition. One explanation for this discrepancy is that the laws simply lack meaningful enforcement. Even if charges are brought against a farm with battery cages, the maximum penalty is only 100 rupees, which is the equivalent of about $5.80. This suggests that a different enforcement-focused advocacy approach is needed in India. Changing the world. Ballard lists his big four priority regions for the farmed animal advocacy movement as China, the EU, the US, and India. Even though the EU and US have only around 1 billion farmed animals each, they join China and India in this list because of their significant influence over the global landscape and because of the existing momentum for change in these regions. Every year, U.S. News and World Report collaborates with BAV Consulting and the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania to conduct a global survey asking for participants' views of different countries. Number one on the list for international influence in 2016 and 2017 was the U.S., which, the agency speculates, is due to its military power, the popularity of its media and entertainment industry, and its position as the world's largest economy. The UK, Germany, and China were in the top five both years, along with France in 2016 and Russia in 2017, perhaps due to the involvement of Russia in international affairs like the war in Syria. This suggests that new food trends and policies in these countries could have a disproportionate influence on other countries, even if fewer animals are directly affected. Unfortunately, it may be harder to make progress in the U.S. due to the heavy influence of corporations, especially the animal agriculture industry, on society and government. The U.S. leads the world in meat consumption per capita and has developed strong associations between animal products and cultural identity. It also lags behind many other high-income countries in terms of its policies on social issues relevant to animal farming. It's ranked 26 in the 2016 Environmental Performance Index, the most reputable such metric. It earned a D rating in animal welfare standards from the international nonprofit World Animal Protection, though Canada and Japan also received Ds. And the U.S. healthcare system is less efficient than that of most other high-income countries, given the extraordinarily high rates of obesity and diet-related diseases in the U.S. The tractability of advocacy in China and India is more uncertain. China's rapidly industrializing economy is causing more damage to the environment annually than that of any other country. But it has become a global leader in environmental policy. Chinese consumers eat around 173 grams of meat per day, but the government recommends only 40 to 75 grams, less than an average American hamburger patty. China has a highly centralized governance system, which makes policy change more difficult, but also makes changes easier to promulgate across the country. Meat has been regarded as a luxury, but it also hasn't been as associated with Chinese cultural identity the same way bacon, cheese, and bratwurst have in many American and European cultures. International organizations have had some success encouraging Chinese companies to reduce farmed animal suffering. For example, the UK-based nonprofit Compassion and World Farming gave their Good Pig Production Awards to Chinese food companies with progressive welfare policies. The Open Philanthropy Project has granted millions of dollars to nonprofits for more of these programs. However, Chinese government regulations of foreign charity involvement are a significant barrier to international organizations, yet another reason to work with and focus on creating and supporting local groups. International companies are also applying pressure. McDonald's sent animal scientist Temple Grandin to China to conduct animal welfare training courses and has increased audits in response to food safety scandals. Ballard thinks that the numerous food safety scandals in China, such as the milk dilution discussed in Chapter 4, have been a key force for the Chinese government and corporations to address factory farming issues. Hong Kong is already seeing promising signs of a transition toward animal-free food. The estimated number of residents who are vegetarian at least one day a week has increased from 5% in 2008 to 23% in 2014. The number of vegetarian restaurants increased from 140 in 2013 to 240 in 2016. This is partly attributed to the success of Green Monday, a company founded by two vegetarians that promotes healthy, sustainable diets and lifestyles. Its leader, David Yeung, helped make Hong Kong the first city outside the U.S. to sell the Beyond Burger. Yeung told me that he's quite optimistic about the future of animal-free food in China. In addition to the concerns about food safety that Ballard cited, Yeung thinks animal-free foods have a special appeal in East Asia because of vegetarianism and popular religious traditions. Yeung's father was a businessman, committed philanthropist, and devout Buddhist who raised him with traditions like eating vegetarian on the 1st and 15th day of each lunar calendar month. Yeung left Hong Kong to study engineering at Columbia University in New York. While in the U.S., he read more on Buddhist philosophy and went vegetarian, coming to believe that the ethical idea of karma made sense in the same way as Newton's third law of motion. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. In recent decades, many young people in China have become distanced from Chinese philosophical traditions. However, Yeung sees a trend back toward them due to both deeply rooted cultural norms and the alignment of some traditions with modern Western interests in sustainability, personal wellness, and animal welfare. I agree with Ballard that these four regions, China, the U.S., the EU, and India, in that order, seem to be the most important for the farmed animal movement. However, these nations hold only around 60% of the world's farmed animals. Elsewhere in the world, there are scattered animal-free food companies popping up, such as the Knot Company in Chile, with products such as Knot Mayo and Knot Cheese. Knotco, as the company refers to itself, uses machine learning to combine diverse plant ingredients and create the right culinary experience for its customers. We also have highly effective activism strategies being replicated across the world, such as Animal Equality, running undercover investigations in Latin America, as it has already successfully done in Europe. We also shouldn't forget the companies that produce the traditional animal-free foods like tofu, which are especially popular in East Asia and likely to remain more accessible than high-tech foods like cultured meat, just as they've historically been more accessible than animal protein. I spoke to Prince Khalid bin Awalid bin Talal of Saudi Arabia about the situation in the Middle East and North Africa, a region known for its popular plant-based dishes like hummus and falafel. Bin Awalid grew up in a $136 million, 460,000-square-foot palace, and as a young adult, took pride in his collection of around 200 luxury cars. Today, he owns only one, an electric Tesla. As an accomplished businessman, following in the footsteps of his father, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal bin Abdulaziz Al-Saud, one of the world's richest men with a 2017 net worth of $17 billion, he has the resources and skills to lead the movement in this politically and economically important region. Bin Al-Walid was born in California and has spent much of his life in the West. He told me that Middle Eastern advocates should remember not to reinvent the wheel. They can simply bring the products of companies like Hampton Creek and Miyoko's Kitchen to their supermarkets, instead of forming new companies and products. In terms of public perception, the situation is similar to that of China, people lack the foundational concern for animal cruelty that we can take for granted in the U.S. Ben al-Walid sees documentaries as a tried-and-true tactic of the West that could be delivered to the Middle Eastern masses via Arabic subtitles. Like in other regions, plant-based eating is currently stereotyped in the Middle East as a niche lifestyle choice for yoga devotees and other small populations. This is why Ben al-Walid prioritizes mass outreach, especially through social media, to show the public that everyone needs to shift away from animal farming. Similarly, lowering the price points of plant-based meat, dairy, and eggs could make a big difference. The movement is expanding to all corners of the globe through its use of welfare reforms, such as cage-free campaigns for egg-laying hens in neglected regions like Eastern Europe, Latin America, and Africa. This work has been largely coordinated by the Open Wing Alliance, a collaboration spearheaded by the Humane League. While this work has obvious direct benefits for animals, it also inspires the creation and growth of local nonprofits focused on the issues of animal farming. This is leading to a global infrastructure for the production and popularization of animal-free foods. It could be a long time before countries that haven't even established a single law for farmed animal treatment start considering whether to get rid of animal farming altogether. But increasing globalization suggests that might happen sooner than we would expect. Animal farming is a global issue with wide-reaching consequences, and impact-focused advocates need to remember that big picture and avoid focusing too narrowly on the change happening in our local communities. To achieve global success, the movement should prioritize work in China, the U.S., the EU, and India. Individual advocates should keep in mind that personal fit, such as cultural familiarity, citizenship, and language fluency, are very important for deciding where to work. It's also important to avoid singling out regions or cultures for reasons other than the total scale of harm. We've already seen significant harm come from the heavy Western criticism of China for the quite uncommon practice of eating dogs, despite the far greater suffering involved in the farming of chickens and fish. Not only can this perpetuate racism, but it can discourage other regions from identifying at all with the farmed animal movement. Why would you want to fight for a cause when its advocates are singling out your country as the enemy? In terms of global organization, the movement should develop and support international organizations and networks that can be more effective by building bridges, sharing information, and coordinating campaigns. But when it comes to the actual day-to-day work of campaigning in foreign countries, advocates should hire, support, and listen to local advocates who probably better understand and communicate with their own culture. 9. The Expanding Moral Circle Revisited. The expanding moral circle, fought for by advocates in every era of human history, could be the most important long-term project of the human species. The initial expansion from the individual to the tribe allowed us to successfully survive and flourish as hunter-gatherers. Extending it further allowed us to work together as agricultural communities, then as cities and countries. Today, we're still figuring out how to extend it to a global scale that allows for peace and international cooperation. We've also made significant strides, and have a ways to go, with fully expanding moral consideration to all genders, sexualities, ethnicities, and other demographics. If our moral circle had expanded more fully and more quickly, we might have prevented or more quickly ended many of history's greatest atrocities, such as slavery, genocides, and wars. Atrocities rely on the exclusion of certain sentient beings from our moral consideration. We look back and praise the advocates who expanded the moral circle, but what will future historians say about the end of animal farming in this broader story? Today, for the vast majority of humans, even most human rights advocates, The over 100 billion animals suffering on farms and in slaughterhouses still lie at the edge of the moral circle. This means that you, as the listener of this book, stand at the moral frontier. You've taken a huge step in considering the interests of farmed animals. However, before I conclude this book, I want to ask, are we who have opened our eyes to the harms of animal farming still ignorant of other classes of victims, perhaps who suffer in even greater numbers? Given that previous generations have been largely ignorant of the pressing issues we recognize today, it seems presumptuous to assume that we're the ones who have it all figured out. Yes, we've been around longer, but people in 1950 could have said that about people in 1850, and they still would have missed the major civil rights progress of the latter half of the 1900s. If we think most people in most other times and places have missed something important in their ideologies, how likely is it that our ideology happens to be the exception? Looking forward. The mark of a civilized person is the ability to look at a column of numbers and weep. Unclear origin, probably adapted from Bertrand Russell. To discover our own moral blind spots, we can consider the dimensions by which our moral circle has already expanded to significant degrees, such as gender, ethnicity, location, from tribes to countries to the entire world, and species, and ask ourselves which similar dimensions exist upon which our moral circle has not yet fully expanded. I'll take a look at a few of these excluded dimensions. Before that, I should note that considering these new frontiers of moral circle inclusion is challenging and can even feel like science fiction. But I'm not hoping to change your mind on these frontiers. I'm only asking you to keep your mind open. It's important to consider that the modern issues of industrial farming would have also sounded absurd to past humans. For example, you might be familiar with A Vindication of the Rights of Women, one of the leading texts of feminism written in 1792 by Mary Wollstonecraft. She argued that girls deserve to have a formal education like boys had, and that women should be able to openly speak their mind like men could. That same year, the philosopher Thomas Taylor responded to Wollstonecraft with A Vindication of the Rights of Brutes, where he argued that by the logic used to give women rights, animals should have rights too, which for him was clearly a reductio ad absurdum. Because animals clearly couldn't have rights, women couldn't either. Fortunately, history proved Taylor wrong. Future humans and animals. The first dimension we'll look at is time. Whether a being exists today, tomorrow, or even 1,000 years from now. We regularly consider beings who haven't been born yet, such as our future grandchildren or the future generations who will bear the consequences of climate change or a loss of natural resources. But this is only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to future beings who could exist in truly astronomical numbers. Estimates suggest that there will be between 9.3 and 12.3 billion humans on Earth in 2100. However, technological advances could enable future humans not only to cover our home planet, but also colonize outer space, and might even be able to do so at an exponential rate, as Earth-based space colonies then send out their own interplanetary colonists. This expansion could even start in the next few decades. Tech mogul Elon Musk is hoping to send humans to Mars by 2025. So just how many people could exist after this rapid expansion? Researchers have estimated that in the long run there could be 10 to the 38th power humans, and even more animals, if humanity colonizes the Virgo supercluster, the massive concentration of galaxies that includes our own Milky Way galaxy and 47,000 of its neighbors. Interstellar expansion presents a tremendous opportunity for a progressive society to expand and flourish, but it's also a terrifying risk for the expansion of inequity, persecution, slavery, war, torture, genocide, and every other tragedy that's happened on Earth. While it might seem speculative and unrealistic to consider a long-term and perhaps unlikely outcome like interstellar colonization, especially given all the suffering happening in our own backyard right now because of issues such as animal farming, the stakes involved are quite literally astronomical, so even a very small chance of affecting these extraordinarily important long-term outcomes could be a moral priority if we really want to do as much good as possible. Proponents of prioritizing the far future argue that it doesn't depend on this Pascalian logic, because we in fact have a pretty good chance of making a big difference in far future outcomes. One technology that could have a critical impact on the well-being of humans and animals in the far future is artificial intelligence, AI. So one way we could have an impact on the far future is through AI safety, working to ensure that AI has positive rather than negative effects on the world. One troubling scenario is if AI progresses slowly toward human-level intelligence, but then, due to its ability to quickly improve upon itself, suddenly overtakes even the smartest human minds. Evolutionary processes took billions of years to shape modern biological intelligences, but a sufficiently advanced technology could modify itself, test those modifications, and learn to improve itself as dramatically in mere moments. It might be tempting to assume that humans would have total control over the AI's goals, or to dismiss negative outcomes as science fiction, but experts in the field see value alignment, whether or not AI will have the same values as humans, as a very tricky problem, especially given factors like the competition between companies and countries to be the first ones to develop such a superintelligence. There are only a few research teams working on AI safety relative to the many researchers working to build more powerful AI. Critical decisions might end up being made by only a handful of people, so someone with the right connections and information could have a significant impact on how AI advances. Could it be the case that impact-focused do-gooders should deprioritize the suffering of humans and animals today, instead choosing to work on projects like AI safety that help beings who might or might not even come to exist hundreds or thousands of years from now? This argument might sound ridiculous, but farmed animal advocates should reflect on their own experiences with naysayers who assert, "It's crazy to think about chickens and fish when so many humans are suffering," or, "Your diet doesn't even make a difference in the scope of the global food system." Would we be making the same sort of error if we insisted on focusing only on those suffering now, even when we can impact so many others through work like AI safety? Doesn't it seem wrong to dismiss those countless future beings because our impact may feel like a drop in the bucket, even if in absolute terms it's enormous? Consider the effective altruism prioritization framework of scale, neglectedness, and tractability. The far future has a scale that's literally astronomically greater than that of the near future, potentially 10 to the 38th power humans at a time for millions of years. It is also much more neglected. Only a few dozen people are employed full-time on these projects. On the other hand, the far future does seem less tractable because, unlike near-term efforts, we don't have many feedback loops to see if what we're doing is working, or much historical evidence to improve our effectiveness. We're left with the question, is it astronomically less tractable, enough to outweigh its astronomically greater scale and its much greater neglectedness? Many effective altruists think not. Wild animals. The most populous group of currently excluded individuals, who may exist in astronomical numbers in the future as well, is the wild animals who exist outside of human civilization, in savannas, rainforests, lakes, oceans, and elsewhere. Many of us care about wild animals to some extent today, just like we care to some extent about future humans. We empathize with charismatic megafauna like pandas, elephants, and orcas. These species serve as spokespeople for modern conservation efforts. We sometimes care about individual, less charismatic animals, such as a wild sheep whose curved horn was stuck around a small tree. A jogger came across the distressed sheep in the woods and helped disentangle his horn, freeing him from what might have been a slow death from thirst. A video of the interaction was posted on YouTube, and viewers applauded the jogger for his courageous action. The rescue of individual wild animals from both natural and human-caused misfortune is widely praised because we recognize that those animals have interests that matter, just like those of our pets. They have the capacity to feel suffering and happiness, just like dogs, cats, and humans. However, there are vastly more wild animals out there who suffer with no hope of rescue. They endure injury, illness, and starvation with astonishing frequency. Yet there has so far been very little research into or advocacy for large-scale interventions to improve their welfare, despite extremely large-scale impacts of humanity on their welfare through transportation, agriculture, and building construction. It's not a question of whether we should intervene in the wild, but whether we should continue with our current haphazard approach. If we applaud the jogger who helped the sheep whose horn was wrapped around a tree, or the wildlife rehabilitators who nurse individual animals back to good health, should we then also take systemic steps to prevent the suffering of all wild animals? One man in Kenya, Patrick Kilonzo Mwalua, is doing this work at the scale of his local community. The pea farmer drives a water truck around the savannah during severe droughts, filling empty watering holes for elephants, buffalo, and other animals who could suffer and die of thirst without his assistance. To be clear, what we're considering here is more than just conservation of natural habitat. Instead, it's the idea of actually intervening in nature to improve the welfare and protect the autonomy of individual wild animals who suffer intensely and in vast numbers. When we assess possible interventions, we should keep in mind the appeal to nature fallacy. When someone argues that nature is inherently good and therefore any intervention is necessarily problematic. There's no reason to think that wild animals have evolved to live in the best possible situation, just as humans aren't living their best lives when suffering from natural diseases like malaria, losing their homes and families from natural disasters, or facing a natural food shortage due to inclement weather or other circumstances beyond their control. We afford individual animals this compassion, as seen with wildlife rescue and rehabilitation. We just fail to think of the masses of wild animals from this individual-focused perspective, instead abstracting them into non-sentient entities like species and ecosystems. Of course, even if we accept the individual-focused, interventionist philosophical view, we face a separate empirical question of how to make a positive difference in their lives. Trying to help anyone stuck in a complex situation, human or non-human, can backfire and cause more harm than good. This is why the field of wild animal welfare has started with research and defining effective strategies for helping these animals, and with advocacy to grow the field and get more people working on this project. Just as we would when breaching a new human issue, like a spreading pandemic that's threatening the welfare of millions of people, we should proceed with cautious urgency, collecting and assessing evidence so we can take action when we have promising interventions we can implement. Uncertainty doesn't stop us from intervening to help humans in desperate need, and it shouldn't stop us from helping wild animals either. Some suggest we do have lots of evidence on the likely effect of interventions to prevent wild animal suffering. Humans have devastated wildlife habitats and populations for most of our history, so this means trying to help wild animals would probably lead to negative outcomes. However, the difference in motivation and methods make this comparison very tenuous. We have almost exclusively seen the natural world as a tool for human benefit, so how could we have expected to benefit wild animals? Instead, we must judge intervention on its own merits. And if all of the interventions we come up with through careful research, including analysis of when previous interventions have used similar methods, look like they will do more harm than good, then by all means, let's not intervene. If your intuitions are still shouting that this is messing with Mother Nature and we should steer clear, consider the perspective of the individual wild animal, just as we did with individual farmed animals at the beginning of this book. If you were an elephant or a mouse suffering in a drought, constantly living with the pain of thirst and hopelessly searching through the grasslands, wouldn't you be happy if a human filled the local watering hole? If you were suffering from an infectious disease that caused a slow, painful death, wouldn't you be happy for medication? For that matter, if someone had the opportunity to provide that assistance to you and refused to do so because they didn't want to interfere with the so-called circle of life, would you accept that, tell them to carry on and die your slow death? Or would you desperately plead for the water or medication they hold in their hands? To be clear, I'm not saying we should go out tomorrow and deliver all the water and vaccines we can to wild animals. I'm saying that as our moral circle expands, we should recognize the interests of these animals and conduct a rigorous evaluation of the upsides and downsides of intervention. We should study all the effects of water provision and vaccination, such as whether it will increase population size and how that will affect the welfare of other animals, as well as other methods it can be used in addition to these or on their own. We should be much more thoughtful in the actions we are currently taking that impact wild animals, evaluating how things like climate change and agriculture affect not just the global ecosystem, but also individual wild animal welfare. Perhaps these projects will have to wait until the end of animal farming and other more apparent causes of suffering. But in the meantime, we can conduct research into and raise awareness of wild animal welfare to pave the way for future advocates. Bugs. We're already in challenging territory, but I want to stretch your moral intuitions even further by considering the case of the tiny animals who live all around us. From spiders to earthworms, we give little thought to these creatures other than to swat at the occasional bothersome mosquito or take a spider out of the house. However, bugs, a term I'm using to refer to all the small invertebrates like insects, spiders, and earthworms, are frequent subjects of academic inquiry, including from neuroscientists and biologists who have studied their nervous systems and behavior. I won't dive all the way back into a discussion of sentience, but it's safe to say that bugs show many of the behaviors we associate with sentience in our own lives, such as fleeing from danger and moving toward food. The best explanation for these actions is that they are driven by emotions like those you experience when you perform the same actions, such as fear in the case of fleeing danger and excitement in the case of approaching a tasty meal. Many bugs even show reinforcement learning, the ability to seek out or avoid an outcome based on previous experiences. On the anatomical level, one study found that fruit fly larvae roll away when a hot object touches them, and that this behavior is mediated by neurons similar to pain neurons in vertebrates. Another found that honeybees become more pessimistic when they are agitated, just like humans do. Again, sentience is a complex topic that we can't do justice to here, but suffice it to say that the evidence suggests many bugs have at least some small degree of sentience, meaning we should afford them at least some moral consideration. This could be a very tiny amount. Say you value a bug at 1/1000th the moral worth of a farmed animal, such as a chicken. Maybe that's still too high. Let's suppose just 1/1,000,000th. Even if that's your valuation, consider just how many bugs there are in the world. Estimates suggest somewhere around 10 to the 18th power to 10 to the 19th power, 1 to 10 quintillion. Using the 1/1,000,000th estimate, that puts the total moral worth of bugs at approximately 5 to 50 times greater than the total moral worth of farmed animals. While this is flimsy and simplified reasoning, it at least suggests that, on the whole, bugs deserve thoughtful consideration. Most of these bugs are wild animals, so we should have the same sort of concerns about the tractability of helping them as we have about helping wild elephants and mice. However, bugs could still face significant human-caused suffering if, for instance, insect-based foods increase in popularity. When I go to conferences and events on the future of food, insect protein is a frequent discussion topic, and there are certainly plenty of foodies who see a big role for it in the future of food. While I appreciate that this food system could reduce some of the harms of conventional animal farming, such as greenhouse gas pollution, the number of insects that would need to suffer and die for a pound of protein is many times the number of cows and pigs, and even fish and chickens. This should make us cautious about a switch to insect consumption because of the greater number of animals involved. One mitigating factor here is that insects might be happier with the confinement aspect of factory farming than mammals, birds, and fish are, but the other aspects of factory farming, like disease and slaughter, are still plenty worrisome. Fortunately, eating insects or other bugs is not very popular at this time, and there's a significant yuck factor associated with insect consumption as compared with plant-based and cultured food. Also, most experts on food ethics agree that plant-based and cultured meat are clearly much better options, even if some think eating insects would still be preferable to the current situation. Artificial sentience. I have one final exercise for your moral reasoning. Sentient beings who are non-natural, meaning that instead of evolving the way humans and other animals have, they are adapted or created by humans or other intelligent beings. Philosophers have considered the possibility that humans will one day create sentient life forms. While we won't fully explore the logistics of artificial sentience, let me provide you with one thought experiment to make the case for this possible technological advancement. Imagine that sometime in the not-so-distant future, you develop a brain disease like Alzheimer's, but scientists have developed a neurosurgical technique to prevent further damage. They plan to replace potentially affected neurons in your brain with tiny computer chips that are functionally identical to healthy neurons. At first, the treatment switches out just a few neurons, but your condition deteriorates, so they continue replacing your neurons one by one. With each replacement, you remain unchanged in everything you feel, think, and do. Eventually, they replace the very last neuron in your brain. The technology is highly advanced, and the surgeons are highly skilled, so you are still exactly the same in all of your behavior and mental processes as you were before any neurons were replaced. Except that those processes are now being run on a silicon substrate instead of a biological carbon-based substrate. In other words, you are you to every outside observer as well as to yourself. In this situation, wouldn't it be appropriate to say you are most likely still sentient and that you shouldn't be treated any differently than you were before the surgery? Situations like this seem theoretically possible. And though this is well beyond our current technological capacities, this possibility of mind-switch technology means that the number of artificial beings that exist in the future could be quite large. Humans could be motivated to do this for a variety of reasons. Computer equipment is very efficient, transmitting signals far faster than the human brain. It's less susceptible to deterioration over time from disease or aging. You could even make copies of your brain to team up and do all the exciting things you've always wanted to do, but never had the time. Whole brain emulation is just one of the ways so-called digital sentience could come to exist. There are many others. For instance, employers could find that digital minds, driven by reinforcement learning, are better and cheaper employees than humans. Some of these minds could be far less sophisticated than human minds, and made to specialize in specific tasks. They could form the labor force of a company that wants to run millions of scientific trials. They could be robotic personal servants, built to feel human feelings in order to understand us better and ensure that all our wants and needs are satisfied. The stars are the limit as human technological capacity grows. If this seems far-fetched, remember that the smartphone in your pocket has more computing power than all of NASA did in 1969 when the first humans landed on the moon. If we do create sentient machines, which many scientists see as a legitimate possibility, we could see these beings being subjected to an immense amount of suffering. Less powerful digital minds could be treated as lower classes, similar to how humans today treat animals as tools and property. In fact, if digital sentience emerges, we could see brand new social movements emerge with these machines to fight against their oppression, just as we've seen for biological victims. Implication: focus on animal protection. How exactly the moral circle should expand is hard to say, but it doesn't seem like domesticated animals should be the final frontier. We should consider what effects we might have today on the moral circle of our descendants. It's not a guarantee that all sentient beings will have their moral interests fully accounted for. The vast majority alive today don't. This is why the way the movement promotes and contextualizes animal-free food is so important. If it ties the rise of animal-free foods in society with concern for farmed animals, it sets major precedent for caring about the large-scale suffering of politically powerless sentient beings, the ones most at risk of being treated poorly in the future. If the end of animal farming is instead tied entirely to other motivations like the environment or human health, it sets a precedent for caring more about those issues, which already have far more people working on them. These values could even conflict with the welfare of sentient beings. A stronger prioritization of human health, for example, could lead people to stop eating red meat and instead eat chickens and fish, which would likely cause more animal suffering. In the long run, a stronger focus on human health could potentially increase cruel animal experimentation if that is expected to be beneficial to human welfare. As discussed in the section on wild animals, the conservation of ecosystems, biodiversity, and other non-sentient entities is only a proxy for the welfare of sentient beings. Intrinsic concern for Earth's current natural environment can actually harm wild animals, such as when humans release biological weapons like poison or diseases on members of invasive species in order to preserve the integrity of local ecosystems, like a plan by the Australian government to release an Israel-based herpes virus to decimate the country's carp population. Preserving the integrity of an ecosystem could be good for the animals therein, of course, but that impact on animal welfare is already accounted for if your focus is directly on their welfare and not simply on the preservation of ecosystems. Advocates should ensure that the social change we create promotes our true values as much as possible, rather than related values such as preservationism that overlap in some but not all contexts. One specific avenue for increasing the welfare of sentient beings is promoting the idea of legal personhood for animals, such as the work of the Non-Human Rights Project discussed in Chapter 1. Just as being treated as a legal person instead of legal property has been a huge stride for oppressed humans, it could greatly benefit non-humans. This reasoning also suggests that we should take care not to privilege those on the borders of the moral circle over those farther outside it. I have been careful in this book to avoid moral comparisons of the animals we eat that raise these animals' status by diminishing the moral status of other populations, such as bugs or robots. An inclusive approach to potential harms suffered by all sentient beings is crucial to the progress of the moral circle. Other ways to affect the far future. Ensuring the expansion of the moral circle, or at least preventing it from slowing down or stagnating, which may be a more important risk, isn't the only way we can help sentient beings in the far future. The moral quality of the universe depends not only on the welfare of sentient beings, but also on how many of them exist. For example, a survey of artificial intelligence researchers suggested a 5% chance of human extinction as a result of AI, meaning no sentient beings would exist. As discussed earlier, devoting more resources to avoiding such an outcome could be highly cost-effective if one believes these sentient beings would be living good, happy lives if only we prevented extinction. Building a good far future not only depends on humanity's values and existence, but also on the ability of existing humans to implement their values. In other words, can they successfully shape the universe into the type of place in which they want to exist? One crucial capability that enables people to implement their values is rationality, the ability to form accurate beliefs about the world and to make decisions that best achieve one's goals. If we believe humanity, on average, has fundamentally good goals, then increasing its ability to achieve those goals could be highly cost-effective. A full analysis of these strategies is beyond the scope of this book, but one key reason to favor moral circle expansion over strategies like these is that merely creating greater power for humans to achieve their goals has the potential to cause not only great progress, but great harm. As a listener of this book, you're familiar with at least some of the terrible suffering humanity has caused. And while much value has come out of technologies like medicine, nuclear energy, and more efficient manufacturing, these same technologies are also responsible for biological and nuclear weapons, sweatshops, and factory farms. The end of animal farming. The end of animal farming is one key step in the broader project of moral circle expansion, and we have spent most of this book exploring the most effective strategies being used to reach that goal. But what exactly will the transition to an animal-free food system look like? We can't know for sure, but my best guess is that there will be two initial areas of expansion for animal-free foods. First, some animal-free foods, especially plant-based, relatively easy-to-make products like eggless mayonnaise, will replace animal-based foods at institutions like schools and catering companies. These purchasers are less constrained than grocery stores by public demand, so they can be won over with relative ease by the low costs of products made from plant ingredients relative to those made from animal ingredients, and ethical mandates like company-wide sustainability goals. This institutional uptake will be driven by leaders like Hooman Shahi, a young entrepreneur who founded Earthrise in 2016 to help connect plant-based companies like Hungry Planet with K-12 schools. Both of these parties are limited in their ability to make these connections themselves. Plant-based companies are new and focused on product. K-12 schools are cash-strapped and embedded in the status quo. Currently, Earthrise's main focus is on chicken nuggets, a particularly harmful animal product that's particularly easy to replace with plant-based protein. While the organization is yet to make a serious dent due to its short existence and small size, just 4 staff, it is building a business and policy framework for a much wider replacement across U.S. institutions. Second, early adopters who consume more expensive animal products, such as at high-end restaurants, will switch those products out for animal-free foods with similar price, such as the first cell-cultured ground beef to hit the market. These wealthier consumers tend to make their purchasing decisions based more on health and ethics than the average purchaser. While this change will do little to directly curtail the factory farming industry, it will allow animal-free food producers to generate revenue and expand their manufacturing facilities, so they can grow to economies of scale and drive prices down. Early adoption by celebrities, entrepreneurs, and business leaders will popularize these products and boost their desirability by endowing them with high status, like how meat has been a symbol of wealth and status in human history due to its limited availability. After substantial expansion has occurred in these two areas, the animal agriculture industry will lose significant profits and have fewer resources for lobbying and marketing, though they will spend a greater portion of their resources on defending themselves. I think this will lead to a net decrease in resources, which will allow, for example, a shift toward recommendations of animal-free foods in the U.S. dietary guidelines, which will facilitate mass adoption, such as by promoting these foods in public school cafeterias. By this point, the average person in the West will see animal-free foods as normal options more than as weird, imperfect alternatives for people with special dietary restrictions. We will also see more blind taste tests showing that products are indistinguishable, since without these, there would always be critics claiming otherwise. This will lead to a rapid expansion of nonprofit organizations focused on animal-free foods, reaching a scale approximately the size of the modern clean energy movement. This is especially important as the animal agriculture industry will be lashing out to maintain its hold on the marketplace. Tech giants and other Fortune 500 companies will commit to serving fewer animal-based foods like how they've committed to clean energy. A reduction of cognitive dissonance will occur as many people stop consuming animal-based foods, allowing those vegans or near-vegans to see and condemn animal farming –